Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 4, Episode 6, titled Camp Elegance. Aaron, what do you think of this episode?
Or as Mr. Harvard would say, no doubt, Camp Elegance.
Wow.
This guy's got such an extra way of pronouncing everything. Oh, my God. I think that at the end of the season, this is not going to go down as the show's best episode. It's physically the shortest episode. It's not a bad episode, but there were a lot of things that I found kind of annoying in where I felt like there's some shortcuts taken in the plot. Some things were a little disjointed. And, you know, some things that I guess other people, like I know Alan Sepinwall's been talking about all season, things I started to finally notice, like just how hard it is for this show to juggle its entire cast and plot. And, you know, like we've seen, there's been notable absence of Nurse Mayflower. Finally got a little bit, not a lot, just a little bit. And it just completely blew Ethel Rita off the stage.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, the Marshall Deffy got blown off the stage other than a 5-second cameo. Is that a fatal problem? Does that mean that I'm not enjoying the season? No. But I did notice it. What did you think? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit overstuffed. It does feel a little bit disjointed. I think, you know, some of that stuff can be fixed in retrospect. Like, I came away from this episode thinking I now understood why they included Orietta Mayflower last episode at all, because they wanted a little bit of time to pass, right, with her struggling with not killing her patients. So, like, in retrospect, I think that worked a little bit better from last episode. And maybe they'll do some of that with the future of these characters. Maybe we'll see that Ethel Rita needed a little time to marinate or something. As it stands, I don't see it. I don't really understand why we would even really bother to include Ethel Rita in an episode like this, where there are already so many moving parts and you're spending a large time sort of away from some of the main characters, and with characters who are barely there, and you know, shine when they're given the spotlight, but other than that, they haven't appeared in the show practically, right?
Yeah, she's just like, Ethel Rita is just kind of simmering there on the literal back burner, I guess maybe front burner, since she's just up front for 30 seconds, and then that was about it. But I want to talk a little bit about some of the behind the scenes inside baseball of Fargo to maybe explain like why this episode did feel a little bit, herky jerky. Do you know what I'm referring to, Jim?
Yeah. I saw that there was an interview with Noah Hawley and people were talking about it, where he said that he re-edited a good chunk of the middle of this season.
Yeah, so there was this, the Hollywood Reporter podcast on September 25th, where they interviewed Noah Hawley, and he mentioned that, I don't know which way it's supposed to go, but this season has an odd number of episodes, and he mentioned that he had pulled parts of other episodes apart and kind of re-edited things to get an extra episode, and I feel like you can kind of see where some of that stuff happens here. And Alan Sepinwall, I noticed in his review, pointed out that, like, there's this boxer character, one of Loy's guys, by the name of Omi Sparkman, that was clearly intended to have a bigger backstory. And you say, well, how does he know that? Again, this is kind of inside baseball, but the actor playing this character is billed as a series regular. And the actress playing Swanee Cap is not. She's billed at a lower, you know, level of importance. But if you're watching the show, you notice Swanee has been in 3 or 4 times the scenes that easily. Omi has been in. Like, has Omi got more than 2 or 3 lines in his whole? He sees that as evidence that this character was cut down in either the casting stage, or I'm sorry, the writing stage, in which case you'd have to ask, well, why was he billed at such and such, or in the editing stage. So it does feel like Hawley really kind of Frankensteined a few of the episodes together. And there's others, like, you know, clearly that kind of reminiscing flashback that Loy has about Dr. Senator is, I think, more evidence. That probably was just a sequential scene in the last two episodes.
Yep.
They pulled it out to kind of do something thematic. And I'm not saying it's not working, but I do think that that's a real challenge when you're in the editing bay and you get a wild hair to do something and you just start making stuff happen.
Yeah, I mean, especially with the COVID-related shutdowns, right? There's no way to really go back and shoot a bunch of stuff like, oh, well, we want to do this, but, you know, we don't have the footage. Well, we got to find a way to make it work in the editing room this year.
But the temptation to do that, to try to, because, like, you're seeing all this time and, like, things happening in the real world and, like, oh, man, there's a thread that I could really pull and maybe make it. I can see why you want to do that, because you got the opportunity. And, I'm not saying this is a bad season or even this was a bad episode. It's just this is the first time I really kind of saw so much of the mishmash that other people that's been bothered other people this season.
Part of that mishmash is coming from the fact that this is a large cast. It has very, very many characters, which is not out of the ordinary for a film in this genre, right? Like there are so many gangster films that have 15 gangsters on the sidelines and one or two main gangsters who are meant to focus on, and you know, sometimes you don't even know their names, right? They'll be in a couple of scenes, they'll have important roles, like they take a character someplace to have them killed, have them wiped off the map.
Polly, we don't have to worry about Polly no more.
That's the thing, like it's not unusual in this genre to have these kinds of large ensemble casts. And so I feel like the show is trying to do something that we've seen many times before, and somehow it's not quite connecting. And I don't think it's awful. I've really enjoyed a lot of individual scenes, but as a whole, like the whole series or the whole season has felt a little disjointed.
Now I'll push back a little bit on that because I feel like I've been liking this season more than a lot of people have, and I think that one of the reasons I did is because like what this show pulled in the first two seasons with the Fishnado and the UFO so shook me tonally to my core that now I'm like, well, fuck it, that's just what this show does. Like,
yeah,
you're gonna have, and you think back to the original Fargo movie, which is kind of the sets the emotional tone. You've got Steve Buscemi plays a ridiculous, terrible character. You've got all kinds of inept criminals that can still do dangerous things. They can still kill people. They can still, mm-hmm. Have outsized influences on the plot. It's just kind of the nature of Fargo that there's going to be some scenes that make you laugh, some scenes that make you squirm, some scenes that make you want to question the state of humanity. And they all kind of live side by side and scene by scene. So I don't know whether I finally stopped worrying and learned to love the Fargo or what, because I know a lot of people like I'm a huge fan of Alan Sepulveda. I read his reviews all the time. He did not have nearly as many narrative problems with those kind of tonal shifts in season one and season two as I did. So maybe he's feeling it now. This is a Fargo too far for him. But I don't know. You got anything else to say? Or should we move on to the episode proper?
Let's move on.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
So as per usual, I've organized my notes into different categories of business. We got smutney, some brief smutney business, some substantial canon and fada business, and then a little bit of Mayflower business at the end. Smutney business, we can discuss this in about 30 seconds and be done with it. Mm-hmm. Ethelreda steps off her bus. Her parents sing happy birthday, which is, there's a whole different tone to this because... in the meantime, Loy has come and shook their tree, and Marshall Deffy came and shook her tree, and they're all shook, but they're going through the motions here. And in the darkness, as she blows out her candles, standing over her right shoulder, the terrifying visage of Mr. Snowman.
Yeah, I thought I was on to something last week. I can't even remember if we talked about this on the podcast or after the podcast. I thought I was on to something with Snowman being like the stain of racism that's always going to be haunting these people throughout the decades of their existence in America. Now I don't really know what to make of it. Is it just a general dread surrounding their lives, a danger?
What put you off that theory? Because I don't think that there's anything that's changed in that analysis, the specter of racism in the family.
Yeah, it just seems out of context in this particular scene.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a theory in her mailbag about this could be a literal personification of death. I do think that, the show has said that this is a story about how people get cursed and houses aren't cursed. People are cursed. So when people go from one, place to another, that curse can follow them. And I mean, I think, systematic overt racism in this season, systematic racism, those are things that qualify. So I don't know that that's a terrible theory. It does feel like that there is something actual, that this is a real dude that had some kind of bad end and might have been at the hands of Zelmer, might have been at the hands of Ethelreda's mom, who I can never Debril. And it might have been at the hands of their father or mother or aunt or something like that. But like some kind of, blood debt is following them. But also, like I mentioned, there's also a chance that this is going to be subverted, that like this is going to be some kind of protector figure rather than a menacing haunting, because he's not doing anything. Yeah, he's acting creepy, but...
Yeah,
he's not hurting anybody.
He might have tried to kill Swanee last episode or a couple episodes ago.
Did he? Because
maybe it's hard to tell.
I mean, it's a paranormal being. He's having some kind of influence on the real world. But I'm sixth sense in this. I'm thinking this is somebody maybe wanting to make contact and be heard rather than. But who knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
But that's the smutney business for the episode, and we're just gonna go away. Oh, I did enjoy the continuity of the dent in the cake that she had tried to frost over, because they gave Zero a big slice as a cake last episode. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to canon business, shall we?
Sure.
Poor Otis Weff, Detective Weff, he's going to get caught up in his canon business. He's going to get caught up in the FATA business. I almost had official police business, but it was just too entwined with the crime business to break it out into its own category.
Yeah.
He arrives home. He gets jumped and wrapped up with a shower curtain.
Yeah, I love how when he gets home, they have a camera sitting in his apartment, and you just hear the knock, and you're like, oh, okay, he's home, right? You can hear it from outside the door. It's like he's announcing his presence every time, a few seconds before he enters the scene.
Yeah, he's like inverse Kramer.
right.
Kramer just busts through and is like, nah, this guy is a different kind of energy that politely comes through after announcing himself five times. But he gets jumped at the shower curtain and someone's asphyxiating them. You know it's one of Cannon's boys, and you think it's like, oh, this is like... Several times this episode, I thought, well, someone's going to die. This is interesting. We're in that part of the season. It's appropriate. But no, Loy steps forward and with a knife pokes a hole so he can breathe. And then informs through a pretty long, menacing monologue that he now owns Detective Weff in the terms of property. What'd you think of the scene?
I like it. I like it. I found myself on second watch sort of wishing that we had a little more, I guess, movement on this part of it. I don't know. By the end of this episode, the war has inched another step further, certainly. But I guess, like, menacing the cop was not on my number one list of priorities here. I don't know. Yeah. I keep waiting for the Mafia War to break. But look, we're still 5 episodes from the end of this season. If the war breaks out too soon, like, once the war breaks out, it's got to be just an all-out fight to the end, right? So you can't do this too early.
Out. Like both sides.
Yeah, but not in terms of like, oh, we're walking into your HQ and gunning people down. It's not we've seen in past episodes.
Like, Fort Sumter has been attacked, but battle lines have not quite formed and clashed yet. But both sides are all in the war. Their only question is the other guy all in?
They're still making strategic moves as opposed to making actual, like, violent physical moves here.
They believe there's an element of surprise to be taken or something like that.
Right. Still talking about negotiation, that kind of thing. But you need that. I mean, we're halfway through the season, right? You don't want the war to break out too early.
Thematically, I thought the scene was pretty strong because he draws a parallel between, you know, what it's like to be owned versus the legacy of black people here in the country. And I'm not just fighting the Italians, and I'm not just fighting, you know, City Hall. I'm fighting this mindset, you know. I thought that was pretty good stuff, but it's like. It's pitched at a level that I don't know it would convince anyone that doesn't kind of, I don't know, maybe it does. Maybe it does.
And it feels it like
did someone that didn't believe it already.
And it's also like the 5th time the show has done this, you know, it's becoming less and less subtle, I guess, every time.
But on the other hand, does Loy really care? I guess, is he trying? He's not, the whole point is he's not trying to convince Weff. This is kind of like just him. This is just cold-blooded smack to say to somebody before you assert, you know, a dominance over them.
Sure.
But I don't know. It's like Weff is in this like weird position, and they have a lot of different ways to reinforce this. Like, there's this Upton Sinclair, the jungle quote that was later in the episode about there's 2 ways to cage a man. One is to put bars around him and everything he wants and loves is on the outside. The other is to put bars around the things he wants and loves and he's stuck on the outside. And like, I feel like that's like, it's not literally true in Weff's case, but like that kind of bars within and without, like he is just completely hemmed in. And, and as we pan out of the apartment, we find out that Marshall Deffy saw this whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
Didn't do and just laid back. So what I mean, the implication here is that Marshall Deffy is staking out Otis Weff, thinks he's crooked, saw all of Loy Cannon's gang go into his apartment. Mm-hmm. What was his assumption? Like, I don't, because he thinks he works for the Italians too. Like, he doesn't care if Weff lives or dies is what I'm getting at.
Sure. I agree with that. He's not about to, you know, bust in and try and save him. Also, I wonder how much he cares in general about the laws that potentially are being broken here. There's so many question marks around Deffy as a character and his intentions, I guess, that I'm not even sure he cares to step in at any point. Like, he could almost be observing this just for his own amusement, right? I
think I take too much Raylan Givens in, because, you know, there's a U.S. Marshal on Justified where he would famously come in and there would be prostitution going, there'd be drugs on the table, illegal weapons. He's like, I don't care. I just want my man. I'm here for the martial business that I'm on, and I don't give a fuck about that other stuff. So, like, is he actually going to get involved between the Cannons and the Fadas, or is he just... But this is going above and beyond. No, I guess not, because he's on the trail. This is still inconsistent, him being on the trail of Zaylmar and Swanee, because...
Right, he might have just followed Loy's guys over to Wef's house and not be staking out Wef. Yeah,
he saw them pack them into there's a drove off. I wonder if it implies that he was outside and he saw everything that happens to Gaetano next.
Possible.
I mean, surely he'd follow a car that had those women in it. Speaking of that scene, we go to Gaetano listening to opera and stabbing dress forms. This guy, I continue to take not seriously.
yeah.
I mean, what the fuck is this? This is some weird shit.
It is. Like, it's intentionally weird.
They're telling me this guy's tough, but they're not showing me.
Well, they're showing you that he's not really. Like, if you look at the rest of this scene, there's so much just fumbling with guns, dropping bullets, shaking in his boots when someone's outside at the door, preemptively firing into his own guy. Like, there's so much around him that says he's not this badass that he pretends to be.
Imagine like if Josto is in the opposite position. They ship him over to Italy for some, you know, to handle some kind of family business, and he goes in Italy and he's got his gangster suit on. He's like, yeah man, they call me, you know, Pezio Vante over in America because I'm the big shot. I'm the 50 caliber. I got a list of dead men. I personally helped Roosevelt, you know, put down the fucking German Bund movement. Like, he's just like, we haven't verified any of this information.
Right.
You know, he's just been talking and getting other people to do his dirty work for him. I'm starting to wonder if this guy's just all bark, because
I mean, he's definitely
not all bark. Like a tough guy.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, is he tough in the face of tough men? Because he's tough in the face of floor sweepers and bartenders, right? Who have no weapons, who have no chance of stopping him. But it's a fair question.
I do think this is a sloppy scene. You know, for the reasons, again, I don't know that's intentional, that this guy's supposed to be a joke or not. But I did think it's sloppy because, like, you know, there's a lot of gunplay. Gaetano ventilates this guy by mistake. Swanee, in the middle of winter in Kansas City, sneaks up on this back porch, opens up a window. This guy's 3 foot away from it. He doesn't feel the chill. He doesn't feel the draft. He doesn't hear this rickety-ass 1950s window sane and...
He's too busy shaking in his boots.
I mean, maybe... In real life, he would be probably deafened from firing that six-shooter times inside. But you don't feel the draft? Listener, I don't know where you're at. It's pretty cold here at Tale of October. I'm toasty warm in my house. If someone opened the door across the room, I'd feel it. I don't know. I felt like it was a little sloppy. Headshot. It's just grazed the skull. Yeah, that can work.
That's almost like Fishnado levels of coincidence. Like, technically, yes, you could probably shoot a man in the head and not kill him, but would it incapacitate him immediately and not kill him?
Would it do better than just going behind him and club him in the back of the head with the gun? I don't know. It's not the worst thing. It's just a little bit loosey goosey. They needed this to happen, and they staged it in such a way that it did. But
there's also I don't know if it's a nice moment. It's just this little meta thing where he gets a shot off, not gets a shot off. He pulls the trigger. But of course, his gun's only half loaded, right? And so the chamber is empty, which makes this sort of a roulette game, like a Russian roulette. And he's firing at Zaylmar roulette. I don't know. Mm. Like, that's got to be intentional, right?
Yeah, that's pretty fun. So the part B to the scene is he comes to and he's chained in kind of this makeshift boxing ring in this gym that Loy Cannon owns. And Loy Cannon starts telling about Sugar Ray Robinson. And he's like, gets started to tell the story of how a man will do anything to get his first break. But it's weird because I felt like he got bored in the middle of what you don't know about Sugar Ray. But then they just kind of like decided not to finish that story. And then he introduces this other guy, Omi Sparkman, who we've seen in the background. The guy's got a dead eye. We find out that he was a boxer, probably got his dead eye, getting his head beat in the ring. He's going to have this guy beat the shit out of Gaetano.
Mm-hmm. Gaetano seems to put on his tough guy act again and start laughing in the face of potentially his death. I mean, that's what Loy says it is. You know, this Dr. Yeah. Senator is the mistake that got you killed.
So maybe this guy's the tough guy too. But that's the thing, is like this speech felt like parts of four other different speeches that ended up with, like, you know, they say one man's life is a whole string of mistakes. What the fuck did this have to do with the other two aborted parts of this story? Well, yeah. Just remember Dr. Senator's the mistake that got you killed. And it not got him killed. The thing
they can write. This show can write some of the best dialogue and the best scenes that I've seen on television. Yeah. I don't know that this is particularly one of them.
Yeah, the connecting stuff doesn't connect as well with me. But I think the other thing is, like, it's frustrating sometimes to watch what's going on because all of these guys are still acting on imperfect information. Like, Loy Cannon's not sure that Gaetano's on the outs with the Fadas, at least with Josto. So he's can't kill him. The logical thing to do is to kill him. Mm-hmm. But he also has to get his son out. And I'm also kind of, I guess I was kind of shocked to find how little Josto cared about Zero. But I don't know. That might make that actually, I think, tracks out. We then see this scene, this odd scene where this is where it definitely feels like disjointed, where he has this reminiscent of, I guess, a scene in the last episode that we didn't see, where him and Dr. Senator hatch a plan to get Satchel back from the Fadas.
Well, they don't even hatch the plan, right? They just imply that Loy has a plan of some kind.
Yeah. Which I'm assuming we're going to see, you know, that's this whole WEF gambit, right? Mm-hmm. But there's this, like, I tried to find out about this painting. I couldn't find anyone talking about it. I couldn't find a search. But there's this rather striking painting of a black man beheaded at the feet of this another black man dressed in these regal red robes. And he's wiping a sword on his garments. And there's blood down the street. I don't know what historic event this is being alluded to. I don't know who painted this painting. I would say, like, it's a depiction of, like, black on black crime, which is an odd thing for this story to address, because it's not about that at all.
No, it's not.
And a lot of times it's kind of a dog whistle for, like, well, we don't have to worry about violence in cities because it's black on black crime. They just need to stop killing each other. Like, you know, 90% of white people killed isn't white people killing white people. Like,
right. That's just crime.
We kill the people.
Right?
We kill the people we live around. America's a fucking segregated country. So there you go. Anyway, I have no idea. If you have any suggestions, fargo@baldmove.com, especially if you know what the painting is, because, like, it was a striking painting. I thought it was very cool. Mm-hmm. But also, like, it felt weird because he's talking about, well, if you rescind the satchel, it's going to be World War III. I mean, we've been talking, this has been, like, three episodes back we're in World War III, so yeah, it's just a weird scene. The Cannon Gang then decides to snatch up Detective Weff in broad daylight, which it does. Like, they did, I guess, a decent job of painting Weff as being on the outside of his own police force. Like, yeah, his captain even kind of suspects him as being corrupt or bent. But, like, holy hell, it does seem like at some point you could just be like, hey, guys, thin blue line, I'm getting pinched by both of these gangs. Let's do something about it. And, you know, it feels weird. And anytime gangsters come after cops, I feel like that's always like that's when they're on their way down the drain. Like, you can do a lot of things.
I mean, this is desperation for sure.
And start murdering judges and murdering cops, and that is when you lose. But I don't think they're telling me that story, so it's weird.
And it works, I think, as an intimidation tactic, because, like, you know, it's similar to, like, if let's say a person has a gun point, a single person has a gun pointed at a group of five people, and they decide they're going to rush him and take that gun. Well, the first person to do it is getting shot, you know. So Weff might realize the first person to call, to call an end to this gang war from the police side is going to get shot. And that's him right now, right? The gun's trained on him. So maybe he's too much of a chicken to actually try and do anything about it.
Yeah, and this goes back to Godfather, you know, Michael Corleone. Hey, let's go kill this cop. You can't kill a cop. It's against the rules. What about a crooked cop? You know, what if you use the papers to take it? But they're not telling that story of Lloyd. Lloyd doesn't have those advantages. So the Michael Corleone exception of like, well, what if it's a crooked cop doesn't apply. It's bizarre. Yeah. It's I feel like a lot of the stuff in this episode needed to happen to get to the other part of the season, but not all of it makes strict tactical logistic sense.
And yet it's the stuff I like most about this episode. I feel like setting up this predicament, these thorny situations that Wef has caught in are like the best parts of it. I like to see him having to make a choice here, right? Is he going to be loyal to this, to the one who brung him to the dance, the Italians, or is he going to switch sides when he's faced with an actual threat of violence, an impending threat of violence, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's an impossible choice to make because you're either sealing your doom in the moment or you're sealing it in the future.
I also really like Chris Rock's performance because he's got a little bit of that comedic thing in there. Like he says, like you got a badge, ain't you? And a gun, like in the same tone of voice that when he's like, pretending to be his dad and talking about how like you know you got to let the Robitussin get to your bone, boy. Like your Robitussin, it's just I think it's really funny the way he's talking. About. You got a gun, ain't you? You got a badge.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. But on the other hand, it is a little cavalier. Because you're trusting this dude who's hanging on by a thread to his like emotional stability, mental stability. He's on the edge of a mental breakdown. You're putting him under enormous amount of stress. You're going to send this dude into the heart of the lion's den to take rescue your cub. Like, it feels like it feels a little foolhardy. Because I think Lloyd loves his kid and would be devastated if his kid dies. So it's weird to me. Okay, this is the point in my notes, Jim, where we switched over to the Fada business. As we see Giusto meeting with the consigliere Ebel. I finally learned this guy's name. Probably not pronouncing it just right. Ebel. Ebel has come back from New York. He was gone all last episode. And the Fadas took advantage of his sober judgment and leadership being gone. He says New York's got two demands for them to back Giusto as being the capo of the family. One, he's got to fix things with the cannons. And it's deliberately left ambiguous about whether fixing is bringing them back to the table to make a deal or killing them. I don't think New York cares either way. I think Ebel has his opinion on which one's better.
And he's got 2 weeks to do it.
The other thing he has to do is make things right between his brother and him.
I love how the scene is cut or how it's structured, you know, because he gets the first demand out, which is fix this thing in 2 weeks. He gets the second demand delayed by the announcement that his brother has been taken. He tries to play it off as like, well, he must be dead. And then they get to the second requirement, which is that they fix things with his brother. And, you know, that puts a wrench in his plan was just to let his brother die, you know, pretend like he's dead.
I don't understand why that as he points out, if the cannon gang kills him in the middle of the war, what the hell could he?
He can't be expected to work it out. Right.
Yeah. So like again, there's the incomplete information. Lloyd doesn't understand the, you know, antipathy, I don't think, between the Fadas, and Fada doesn't know that. I don't know. Like I don't understand why this complicates it. The show treats it like, oh, well, you've got to rescue your brother now, and then a beat later they have a scene where he reveals that no, actually, I'm going to do the thing that seemed like it's the obvious thing to do, which is just let him die. You know, I didn't quite understand what they're going with that.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't seem like there's a super strong correlation between the two, but I guess the way I looked at it is the consigliere is Ebel is the guy who's kind of communicating with New York, and you need him to be telling New York that you tried to cooperate, you tried to make it work, right? And if Gaetano isn't known to be dead, and Evel knows that you are kind of not trying to save him, he might report that back to New York. Although I don't know what kind of breach of trust that is with your capo or whatever.
Seems like that would be going against the family, but maybe serving the greater family.
Yeah, yeah, hard to say. So that's my interpretation, is like, because the consigliere is sitting right there going, like observing him not trying to save his brother, that might look bad and that might cause, you know, further problems.
Yeah.
But that's pretty generous, because I don't think they make that super explicitly clear.
Yeah. So then you got him confronting Calamita, which this is just, again, this is some weak shit. Like, whose side are you on? We know what side he's on. You know what side he's on. What is this? This is criminal incompetence, which tells me Josto's probably going to end badly. But
so Josto's too soft. Josto needs to be talking about having this guy take a ride this episode. And he does. He punishes him, right? Like, when he says, go teach him about loyalty, he's talking about probably beating the shit out of him, if not killing him straight up.
Really? You think so?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's weird to say that in front of the guy. Especially since the Calamita doesn't seem like he's in for an ass beating the way he's going.
That's his plan, right? Because like he says later in the episode,
I thought he was talking about, Calamita telling Wef, like teach him about loyalty, which is why Calamita was so heavy handed and demanding with him.
He calls for Wef to be. Well, then they go. I don't know about that. Maybe you're right.
Fetch him.
They go grab him.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a little, I mean, your interpretation, I think, is not like out of left field.
And
I don't think mine is 100% certain.
They don't get to the resolution of that either. Everybody right. who's in that scene is still sort of out in the wind. I guess Calamita has gone over to Josto's place and grabbed Wef. So maybe you're right.
Calamita also, I don't understand. Nothing he said should have talked himself out of anything. He's like, come on, boss. Right. I've known you since you were a baby. That's a fucking problem. He doesn't take Josto seriously. I don't take Josto seriously, and I didn't even know him when he shit in his pants, you know? Then we have this interesting split screen.
Well, so he is going to clearly throw Calamita under the bus, right? Like, that's the thing. His plan here that he lets slip to Antoon is that he's going to make it look like Calamita has gone rogue under Gaetano's orders. Let them kill Gaetano because Calamita has killed Satchel, right? Uh-huh. That's the plan. So you're probably right about the fact that they might be talking about Wef when he says teach him a lesson about loyalty, but also he is going to give up Calamita.
Yeah. But why the subterfuge? Why wouldn't he have just Calamita go and kill the guy's son? Like, it's like, well, you don't want to order that because it'll be like all of this is in kind of happening in front of the consigliere. So it's like it's weird. It's like you're right. I understand the on the face machinations of it, but like it doesn't seem like that's the way you would go about it. But then again, it's a little blurry for me because you're dealing with incompetent criminals. Right. The only time the incompetence bothers me is when it's Loy Cannon. And I thought his plan on getting his boy back seemed harebrained and not serious. Like a 50-50 coin flip at best. And do you do that with your youngest son? I don't know.
Yeah.
We then have the split screen of Josto and Cannon, which I think is I thought was trying to show the difference between the seriousness and studiousness of, you know, like even as he's plotting this gang war, like, you know, Cannon is like going over his numbers and like still obsessed with his business, where Josto is distracted about the silk lamp by his desk and, you know, like all these like trappings of power. He's just not. It's the difference between. It's a difference between a guy who is handed something renovated and a guy who's built something from the ground floor up. But yeah, so we didn't. Then we have another thematic scene where you've got Rabbi Milligan, which I think it's a nice touch that rabbis are traditionally known as teachers, and he's literally this guy's teacher. And they're reading a quote from Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, where he it's this quote of this man who's he's a working class stiff. He's been out of his job. He's down to his last few pennies. He's eating stale bread and he's realizing, oh my God, I'm going to starve. Like, I've got like maybe a week or two or three left and I'm going to starve. And everywhere I go for a handout, authority is giving me a face in the boot. And there's hundreds of guys just like me. So like the odds of any one of us getting out of the situation, it's a man essentially learning he's going to starve to death in the middle of, you know, one of the wealthiest cities in the United States. It's interesting, the fact that that is resonant for a lot of people nowadays.
Yeah.
But so they got him talking about that. This is also where you got the quotes about the guy who's you got bars on the outside, bars on the inside. And it's great this shot of like Wef kind of stalking Satchel, and the way they cut it, I thought was really good. It's really it built a lot of tension. Like they rapidly cut between Wef reaching for his gun, Satchel reading the story, Rabbi kind of like sizing this guy up and being like, okay, maybe I should reach for my gun, and then they break the tension with fucking Kalamita. I thought it was a good. This is one of the best scenes in the episode.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they take Wef outside and they commit another unforced error. Jim, you've seen a lot of gangster films. Where do you sit the guy in the organizations you don't trust?
in the front seat.
Yeah,
to the right. With the guy behind you.
Do you give a man with a gun that you don't trust? Did you let him sit behind both of you? Nobody back there babysitting.
No, you definitely don't.
It's two unforced errors, because not only are these Italian gentlemen just totally bad gangsters, but also Wef, this was his way out. You let him get like halfway between where you are and where you're going, pop both of those guys, go back, get the kid. Now that you've peeled off half of the muscle in the house, and then I would have bought him being a lot more trapped if he was sitting in that passenger seat with some unknown goon with a gun to him.
For sure.
I don't understand why they did that.
Yeah. I don't know. That seems like a sloppy mistake.
Yeah.
But so, they're sloppy. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not the best Italian gangsters.
But as Wef, I guess, you know, again, Wef is not got, he's got a lot of problems, right? But this, and maybe he's just so, you know, he's so spiraling inside his mind that he isn't able to take advantage of this. But I just feel like it was a screenwriting error. Like they just messed up. They messed up the dynamics there, and weren't even aware of it, unfortunately. So the other part of Giusto's plan, which is to get this character named Antoon, to go to the house, tell Rabbi to go meet him, Giusto, and then take the boy for a drive. And we all know what that means. Poor Antoon knows what it means, but he's not sure he can do it. And I think some of this stuff is some of the best in the episode too.
Yeah.
Do you think it's weird that, that Rabbi Milligan didn't suspect anything?
He does very much just like, oh, the boss wants me. Okay, put on my coat and go. Oh, I got to go by myself. Okay, no problem. A little bit, but also, I think he has more trust in this organization than maybe he should. You know, maybe. For a guy who, I don't know, has seen how fickle this can be. It seems a little strange.
And I guess like Antoon was shocked. I guess I was too, because. Yeah, I'd almost forgotten that Zero's not Giusto's son.
Yeah.
It's just his little brother that came along a long time after him to his dad that he had kind of a complicated relationship with. So you suddenly went from having a valuable hostage to, but I'm kind of surprised that Rabbi Milligan didn't get that math either. He was a little too, and they showed that he does these errands a lot. You know, he has a standard routine with Satchel, right? I just thought it was weird that at this stage in the war he wasn't a little bit more, you know. But on the other hand, what could he do? Just defy the boss?
Yeah, I mean, Giusto is everybody's playing like big, making big fucking bets in this episode. And they're doing them on barely their plans. Like, I look at Josto's plan and it's like, okay, he could hold on to Satchel and use him as a bargaining chip to get his brother back. Oh, but he doesn't want his brother back, right? His brother's a nuisance and a problem.
Sure.
So instead, he's going to burn his only card, and by having Antoon kill Satchel and then trying to blame it on Kalamita, hoping that they'll kill his brother in retribution and that that will sort of even things out somehow, or that he can rely then on New York to bring in the muscle he needs to win this thing. It's like, it's a huge bet. And he's willing to just go with it on a whim, seemingly.
I thought they did a really good job selling Antoon as just being a guy who can't really do this. Like, but still some doubt, yeah. Like, cause he also keeps making these allusions to like not wanting to go back, not wanting to, and they, you know, I think is a pretty good sketch of a guy, like almost a nice short film that they made here about this guy.
Yeah, we've talked about how in The Walking Dead they try and do this constantly, right? Like make a character in the very episode you're going to kill them. Here it works, and I don't know if it's just because the writing is so much better in these scenes, or if it's something else going on here. To me, it's the writing. But yeah, this is risky. This is hard to do.
It's not just the writing. It's also that, like, we don't need to feel a certain way about Antoon. He's not the point of the scene, you know? It's like he's not making heroic, defining sacrifice. He's just a pawn that gets shot. And also, they've done some character work. Like, this guy with Paulo was the guy standing at the bar drinking limoncello in like episode 2, why Gaetano was, you know, making his first crazy eyes pitch. So like, I it's not like I didn't know this guy.
I didn't recognize him
at all.
He was
a little bit of a cowardly lion type dude anyway. But so here, and you tell this guy also is like, come on, boss, what about Zero? I don't give a shit about Zero. What about Gaetano? They said to try to make peace with Gaetano. So he goes and does all that. Rabbi doesn't suspect the thing. There's like the fourth unforced error in this episode. Josto goes, hey, okay, Rabbi, you're back in the gang. Go see Ebel for your assignment. And he goes, well, what about the kid? The kid's done. I thought the whole point of getting Rabbi away from the kid was to keep Rabbi from trying to protect him or do something to disrupt it or whatever that did. Like, but was it just an accident? Did Josto just really mean, hey, I need a new soldier? Because if he had just said, don't worry about the kid will keep at Antoon's house for as long as you're needed. Just go talk to the consigliere. This episode's done. Like, Satchel gets his brains blown out, or maybe not, because Antoon doesn't have it in him. But
that's a bad choice of words. Yeah, it's foolish.
Yeah. So, like, did Josto not know that Rabbi Milligan was getting really attached to Satchel and seeing him kind of as a father figure, guardian, protector?
No. Josto believes in, for whatever fucking reason, because he himself doesn't show these qualities, but loyalty. He thinks that his guys are loyal to the end, and he can tell them absolutely whatever. Because look at how he handles his plan with Antoon, right? He spills all the beans on his plan. Like, he's going to throw Kalamita under the bus. It's going to be Satchel's going to be killed. Like, all the stuff with Antoon telling him his plan before it's even started to be carried out. I think he does the same thing with Rabbi here. He thinks, well, if I say the kid's done, and Rabbi is just going to go along with it.
Especially since the rabbi had made that big speech about, like, hey, you know, I'm loyal. Look at me. I told you this thing. I acted on behalf of the family. I'm always looking out for family. I guess I can see that.
But it's hypocritical, right? Because he himself is trying to get his brother killed. There is no loyalty there, right?
But then again, his brother fucked him over first, too. Like, it's...
Yeah,
you know,
but business,
that's
business,
more all
family,
part of the game, I think. Yeah,
business,
yeah,
family,
yeah.
Country, right? And I guess business is taking precedence here.
Yeah. So the rabbi correctly interprets this is bad for Satchel, rushes back to Antoon's house and shakes his wife and says, what about the kid? So he kills a Fada goon to show that he's serious, and he's now committed. You know, he's now he's now gone against the family, and she apparently tells him, gives him an idea about where he might have gone. And then we get this scene, this wonderful scene where the episode's title derives its name from Camp Elegance, which I'm not sure. I looked this up. I think this is a fictitious thing. Like the name of it, but maybe not. I spent like 15 minutes trying to find camp, you know, Camp Elegance, Italian POWs, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. It's a place where when Americans captured Italian fascist soldiers, they took them to be held till after the war. And he cites this Monte Cassino campaign. That was one of the last, it's funny the synchronicity, because this was all a loose part of the plot of Westworld too. But this whole Winter Line campaign where the Allies were trying to push into fascist Italy and seize the joint German-Italian occupation. And I guess this is like one of the major battles that like kind of broke the back. It happened. It started in like the dead of winter in January, which makes sense that, you know, Antoon is starving. He's a soldier. He's eating his boots. He's eating his belt. So there's a nice little bit of like background color. And then Antoon essentially tells us the important part, which is he was brought here as a starving Italian, disillusioned that these fascists had run his country into the ground. And he comes to America, the land of plenty, the land that made him strong, the land that made him, you know, what he is today.
Yeah,
and how he took a blood oath that he would do anything. It would do whatever it takes to become an American.
Mm-hmm. He carved it in stone, right?
He carves it in stone, and what he's being asked of now is the murder of Black Child.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, Satchel is one of the cutest kids I've seen in a television show in a long time. This poor kid,
so
oh
innocent,
my God,
so naive.
My heart melts every time I see him. And the thing is like, that's a kind of a little bit of an unforced error, because I feel like Satchel's portrayed as being smart and perceptive. He's like still waters run deep kind of guy. There's so many flashing red shots that these people are going to kill you. That's delivered by Satchel, like the mom crossing himself and going, "Adios mio, what's going?" And you know, this guy talking and like, "Hey, yeah, go down in this grave," essentially. And And they don't, like, I thought that at first the Satchel was playing it kind of like, I'm scared and this is, but what am I going to do? But then he gets down at the carving. He's like, "Oh, cool. This is really neat." And I'm like, "Well, what the fuck?" Maybe he's simple. I don't know.
Or maybe he doesn't live in a world where, you know, 100 gangster films have been made. And we know which
film
seat to put. Right, right. But living in a gang, he might be too close to even recognize any of this stuff, right? Like,
that's true.
I don't know. I feel like we have the benefit of like all of these tropes that have come from the cinema of Italian gangsters.
You're not wrong. So Antoon decides at some point that he just can't kill this kid. And he goes to put his gun away. And I swear to God, I thought he shot himself.
Same here. Yeah.
And I'm like, well, this is interesting. And then, nope, it's actually Rabbi Milligan that delayed him.
That moment would feel so Fargo, right? You go to put your gun away, realizing you can't kill this kid, and boom, you shoot yourself in the chest.
Yeah, it's cocked. It takes a hair trigger to fire it at this point. And this guy's kind of an inept criminal. Like, yeah, you just shoot yourself in the belly. And I'm like, well, that's going to be interesting. But then
there's
Rabbi
another
Milligan,
like very Fargo moment with Zalmayr and 20. Capture Gaetano, because like they can't move him. Like they didn't think far enough ahead to realize, oh shit, he's a very big guy and we can't move him. I thought that was very Fargo.
I thought, yeah, and I was thinking the whole time, like, why weren't the cannons there, like waiting in the wings, like as soon as the guns, like, you know, like, yeah, these are badasses, but if you wanted to capture him alive, what was the plan there?
Right.
To capture this human wrecking ball with a 12-inch butcher knife. I don't know. But yeah, Rabbi Milligan rushes in and, you know, sees if Satchel's okay and tells him, like, look, I'm going to give you the choice I was never got. I was drafted as a child soldier. I'm going to get you out. And it's heartbreaking when this sweet boy says, am I going home? And he goes, that's not safe either.
Yeah.
And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you someplace safe and quiet, and we're going to let all this blow over. And then if you want to go back home afterwards, I will take you there. And Satchel affirms that he trusts him. And he says he's scared, and Rabbi says he is too, and that's where the episode ends. But we still got a little bit of business. Do you have anything else you want to talk about in the Canon business or the FADA business before we move to the Mayflower business?
I just think it's interesting. You know, if he does actually get a choice and he does actually turn out to be Mike Milligan, the choice that he made is fairly interesting, given that he's part of the Kansas City Mafia, who is maybe run by the New York Italians. It's a good question, because Joe Bulo shows up in this episode, and I don't know if we have feedback about this, but I'm going to talk about it. If you don't remember, is Brad Garrett's character from season 2, who is like a fairly high up. He's the boss of Mike Milligan.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
Damn, I didn't make that connection.
So there's a lot of implications here that, like, New York Italian mafia is running the Kansas City mafia in the 70s, right?
Well, and that checks out with, like, I just recently watched Casino, and that's like all about it, that the Kansas City branch of the Italian family is what was running directly the money operations in Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. that all checks out.
And I just think it's funny to see the choice that he makes is to go right back into this life with a new organization. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't end well for him.
And that's assuming he gets a choice, right? Like, Rabbi is going to try and protect him, but who knows if he can.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought this was a great scene. I'm kind of interested in seeing the traveling roadshow that is going to be Satchel and the Rabbi on the run. It sounds like a Starsky and Hutch. Satchel and the Rabbi. Jake and the Fat Man. Like, this has got all the makings of a classic series. Yep. Fargo season 5 confirmed. Let's talk about the Mayflower business, the medicine business here. Mr. Harvard, I guess, calls Nurse Mayflower into his office about this anonymous letter he's received. We saw Ethel Rita drafting this last episode.
Am I crazy, or is it not an anonymous letter? She signed a fake name on that, right?
Oh, I thought it just says Mr. Harvard. I didn't. Okay. The outside of the envelope just was addressed to him.
It certainly was, but I thought I remembered last episode that when she was writing it, she gave a fake name.
You could be right, and he was pretty coy about it. There's a couple things that he's coy about, like she asked to see the letter, and he says no.
God.
But then he puts it in his top drawer, and the camera follows it there,
follows it there, right? Like.
You might be right that she did sign some kind of fictitious. Now, she does kind of like Kill Bill the Bride. Like, it didn't have the wah, 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 but like when she started seeing the handwriting, Mayflower has a nice sample of Ethel Rita's handwriting.
Oh, yeah.
It's something we talked about a couple episodes ago. She left her journal inside Nurse Mayflower's closet of horrors. Her trophy
right.
room.
I wonder if she realizes she has that sample. Because, like, the you know, the question is, like, oh, does she recognize the handwriting? Has she read that journal? Does she know even in there yet? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and, like, is that the reason she's being so good at the new hospital? Is that she knows that she's got this kind of hanging over her head that she's been fretting about what Ethel Rita knows? Has she actually realized that yet? I feel like that rage fugue state she went into kind of implies she has, but
yeah.
Definitely there's that to be put two and two together though and make four for sure.
Yeah.
But she does go into like this almost fugue state of rage about the letter where she disassociates while he's talking. And This guy's diction, man. You know, of course, I know. It's forbidden to take the possessions of your patients. It's
like, he's perfect. What? I love it.
Jesus Christ, man, this guy. But then he says he's going to have to show it to HR, and she goes, "Oh, please don't. You know, you got excellent references from me, and I've been nothing but good here." Because you were right. I wasn't sure exactly what they were trying to portray last episode, but her just trying to.
White knuckling that.
Yeah, not killing my patients. This
right.
guy this guy's got the gout so bad. Oh, I could kill him right now, man. Be doing mm-hmm. everybody a favor. And it's funny because even Mr. Harvard was complaining about old Goutmeister G yeah. here. And
if this was an Italian gangster saying, hey, it'd be great if that guy quieted down a little, you know, she'd go and she'd murder him and the guy would be happy that she did it. Like,
exactly. And Nurse Mayflower, it's like, it's a great scene because she just emerges from this inky darkness after mm-hmm. this guy goes silent and she's just got this radiant look on her face. Yeah. And then they have this great little 50s bop by Julius La Rosa, Pass It On. It's just about how if you got a happy feeling, man, you can't keep it to yourself. You gotta give that to others. And I thought it was a really great way to end the episode.
Here's the thing. I still have no fucking idea why I'm seeing any of that. Why do I care about this?
Where's the Giusto connection?
Yes, that's what I mean. Like, where does this connect with anything else we've seen in this show?
Yeah. I mean, she's got her own story to tell, but like, it's also connected to Giusto and this mistaken identity and or not mistaken identity, just mistaken idea of her own importance to Giusto, which has got to eventually come to fruition. But they've just really let the Giusto part go. Well, I will, in the show's defense, like these last three episodes have happened within 24 hours of each other, right? Mm-hmm. So like we're only the next day from her giving Giusto the chokey, which was only like a day after her giving her the handy in the parking lot. So like maybe I'm but I still think narratively it doesn't matter. You know, you can explain right. a lot of these things, but it does feel like it starts to add up to being, as you said, you know, as we both said, disjointed.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
I want to start feedback by addressing some feedback I got from on social media from some Native Americans calling me out for my use of the words off the reservation and referring to a Swanee cap. I want to just kind of address that real quick because I looked into it and I found out, it's like, oh boy. The origin of the term going off reservations is demeaning to Native Americans because it referred to those that chose to resist the confinement on the reservation. These natives are the ones that were actually fighting against the destruction of their religion, their customs, their language, which of course is something Swanee is referred to in this season. And to do so, they had to go off reservation to do it, you know? And there was this contrast and connotation between what was called back then a good Indian that would stay in their reservations and not cause trouble to do what they were supposed to do versus the off-reservation Indians, which were regarded as savages that were likely to rape and murder. So an Indian not cordoned off onto a reservation was inherently dangerous, you know, and, you know, that was also like a phrase at the time, the only good Indian's a dead Indian. So when I said that Swanee had figuratively and literally gone off the reservation, I thought I was making pretty clever off the cuff. That was not in my notes. I was just kind of freestyling there. Because I was saying that she's refusing, just like the episode said, she's refusing to follow society's rules. She's, you know, uppity. She's gone outlaw. But, you know, the implication when you say someone's gone off reservation is they should be brought back on or shut down. And in the old days, that was literally shot down, right?
Yeah.
So I can see how Native Americans would be uncomfortable, upset if they hear those terms used, especially in the terms of a throwaway joke. And I think Native peoples in America especially have a hard time getting kind of traction on their issues as opposed to other minorities. Not like any of them have it easy. But, you know, this nation spent a lot of time, effort, and treasure trying to destroy them, and did a really good job in the attempt. So there's just comparatively few of them to kind of fight for their rights and their issues. So I apologize for my part in that, and I appreciate the education. So let's move on to our first email again. Fargo@baldmove.com is how you get in contact with us. Rose in Kansas City has a quick note on the set design. I found this very fascinating. I'm noticing, almost distracted by, the absurd number of lights and lamp fixtures in every indoor scene this season. The Smutney's kitchen has 5 overhead schoolhouse lamps. The Cannon's home has a crazy number of lamps, sconces, ceiling fixtures, just to name a few. At first, I thought it was maybe to assist with the lighting on the set, but in episode 5, I noticed some lights were turned off, yet clearly still in the shot. For example, 2 of the kitchen lights were turned off behind Thurman's head as they give up the funeral home and the sister. Am I imagining things, or are lights keeping score for us? Would love to know your thoughts.
I haven't even noticed it.
I hadn't noticed it either, but I think that Noah Hawley's not above this kind of obvious symbolism, and it reminds me a lot of like the red light theory in Mr. Robot, about anytime you saw like red lights, it was it led to someone, a character's death. So yeah, you know, if you had 5 lights and you'd say they represent the Smutneys, their business, and their sister's relationship, and 2 of them are turned off. Although I guess I would not say it's I would say it's both Swanee and Zelmer, because it's almost mixing a metaphor to like, oh, and also the funeral home. So like if Thurman, for example, gets pinched and another light's off, then I think you're onto something there, Rose. But I do love this shit. So I hope you're right. I hope you're right, because that's cool.
Yeah.
Scott V has some comments here. I love the Fargo movie and the series, and I love your coverage of same. The movie and each seasons have been prefaced with, this is a true story. Now, we all know they're not. What are your feelings on the ethics and or morality of saying something's true when it's not? Jim.
That's just Fargo. Like, I have no problem with that. This is fiction.
Yeah, I mean, storytellers are professional liars.
Sure.
And like in, you know, we just covered Red October, right? They had a whole crawling screen about, this actually happened in 1980, blah, blah, blah. That's, I think everyone's supposed to realize, and sometimes we forget, you know, like there's a time when Orson Welles pulled a whole thing about invasion from Mars, got a bunch of people upset. There was a very smaller scale of that when, do you remember when the Blair Witch Project came out? People were actually saying that was real found footage.
Absolutely.
But most people are in on this joke, you know, and if not, Google, is Fargo real? You know, it's a town in North Dakota for sure, but like that'll dispute them. So storytellers are professional liars. I enjoy it when they do stuff like this, a little bit of heightened realism. I don't have a problem with it.
And I think everyone would do well to remember that. Even documentaries, even things that are pitched as, this is actually true, you need to look at, and you need to say, is this actually true? And you need to figure it out by doing research if you want to actually believe that it is true. You shouldn't just like let a line on a screen, a caption on a screen, tell you that a thing actually happened. That's not how fact works.
That's not how you acquire accurate knowledge, indeed.
Yeah.
They continue, as loving the discussions of season, just wanted to throw in, I thought the ghost dude was actually Death. the personification of. When Ethel Rita opens her doors and sees him just sitting there, I assumed it's Death. I mean, where else would Death be, hang out than a mortuary? Mm-hmm. Makes sense. But then after he came out of the tub and Zelmer sensed him, I thought maybe the family has a genetic predisposition to sense death. So my take is that more as a family is haunted by being able to see death instead of being haunted by a ghost. Is this plausible? Please discuss. Is it I mean, it's tough because, like, is it plausible? Yes. Is it supported by the text? I don't know, because, like, unless you say this person's death, you have to assert something that the show itself is not, which is this person represents death, and then kind of play that out. Sensing death, like, why was death around Zelmer and Swanee in that scene?
I mean, I thought it was just because she might have been so sick she was going to die.
I didn't feel like she was close to death. She's just having a bad time. And I guess they killed a person in... It's an interesting idea, and it does have some things going for it. But my question is, narratively, what predictive value does that have? Or what is that, you know, like, if it's just death, well, you know, is death going to decide not to kill someone or kill someone? Are they going to be able to intercede for somebody? Like, that's where it would, and that's, like, I don't know, because is Fargo ever gone that fucking supernatural meta? Like, you got, like, Seventh Seal kind of, like, deal with death thing. I don't know.
Yeah, but, I mean, death has definitely been, you know, a part of Fargo. Like, we talked about Nikki Swango's experiences in some sort of afterlife or, you know, at the pearly gates sort of thing in season three. So... yeah, they could definitely go there. I mean, I guess you could look at who it's stalking, right? It's stalking Ethel Rita. It's stalking Swanee. Those are the two people we've seen it approach. We've seen it around. So maybe that says something about their future.
I just keep coming back to, like, this is directly connected to Zalmer and Debril and their family. And it was explicitly that connection made with what Swanee said. So... Mm. It feels, and they said the word haunt, you know, like this thing haunts people, but they've also referenced the devil, you know, in terms like that too, and the shadows and things that cling to people. So if you want to say it's a personification of death, keep that in your back pocket, and let's see how it plays out the rest of the season. Rai Rai says, as the opening credits of episode one of this season of Fargo started rolling, the name that most caught my eye was Andrew Bird as Thurman Smutney. Andrew Bird is responsible for one of my all-time favorite albums of music, Thrills by Andrew Bird's Bowl of Fire. He's also a member of the once-famed Squirrel Nut Zippers.
I didn't know he was in that band, but I did know he was a musician and not necessarily
an actor. I did too, and I looked in his Wikipedia, and I'm like, I don't recognize any of this shit. But Squirrel Nut Zippers, fuck yeah, I recognize. They were the Afterlife guys, weren't they?
I believe so. Did they also do Zoot Suit Riot? Is that one of theirs?
Could be.
They got a couple of popular radio hits in the 90s.
Yeah. I was pumped to see if his musical charisma would carry over to his acting, and I'm afraid it is not.
What?
I do think he's funny in the role, but in a way that reminds me of the same way some rando would deliver a line to Candace Cameron in the Aurora Tea Garden mystery that gives her the aha moment that helps her solve the case. I have no idea what the hell that means.
I mean, it's better than Candace Edge.
Cameron, Aurora Tea Garden.
Yeah, I have no idea. That's probably a Squirrel Nut Zippers thing or another one of his bands. I don't know. He's better than Ed Sheeran was in Game of Thrones. So if that's the bar by which we judge, I feel like he's doing a great job. I have no problems with his performance. I like the characterization of Smutney here, Mr. Smutney. Yeah.
Does he bring anything to the table? I don't know that he brings a lot to the table, but he's
that
not
character
he's not
isn't
stealing
supposed
silverware.
To, right?
Right, yeah. Like, he's doing what he's supposed to do. He's playing kind of a kind, well-meaning putz that gets pushed around by just about everybody in his life. Rai Rai says, loving the season of Fargo and loving the insight you're giving to each episode. Well, thank you. It means a lot. Yeah. Joel says, something struck me while watching episode 5. With the climate of the pending gang war, I wonder if the few extra seconds it takes Otis to open the door will be the difference between life and death for him or another character. I'd like to know your thoughts on this and who you think that might be affected if this comes to pass. I saw some vigorous nodding here, Jim. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they are lingering at him, announcing his presence every time he enters or exits a room, seems to be setting us up, for either him to get somebody killed by announcing his presence or ruining a plan by announcing his presence or something, right?
Yeah, no, narratively, that's the only purpose it serves. Like, it's going to be, it's Chekhov's knock, right?
Absolutely.
Because I think you covered most of the possibilities. The other possibility is his arc is going to be overcoming that. And I don't, like, not overcoming and like, oh, he's just going to whip OCD, but kind of like through some kind of sheer force of will or effort. Defy his nature for a singular moment of either heroism or sadism or villainy, I should say. That's the other thing I was thinking of. Because, otherwise, it's just, they're belaboring this point. You are intentionally supposed to notice it for sure. Andy Blaine in Minnesota. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Andy from Blaine, Minnesota. Fargo is my favorite show, and I'd like to shout out my buddy Tony, who told me about your wonderful podcast. Well, thanks for calling our podcast wonderful, and Tony, thanks for being a cool dude and getting the word out. He says, I'm loving the season, but I think Jason Schwartzman is miscast in the role of Josto. I think he's great in the comedic parts, but I don't think he pulls off the tough guy bit at all. Think about his America Loves a Crime Story speech. I don't buy him as the guy with the gat. I meant to mention that last episode, that he can't even properly do the onomatopoeia of a gat. Like, there's a lot of ways you can do like a Tommy gun sound, and whatever he did is not it. He was a colicky pig, not a Tommy gun or a gat, you know?
Yeah, Jason Schwartzman likes to make interesting choices with his acting, and most of the time that serves him very well. He maybe needs to show another side of himself in this show, but I'm with you. I haven't really seen it so far. I think he's okay. He's just not great.
I know we had similar concerns about Chris Rock in the beginning of the season, and I think he's largely completely put those to rest. Like, he's a funny guy, but he also can be menacing and cool and calculating. Josto's just a fool. Like, all these FADA boys seem like they're idiots, one way or another. Like I said, we've got, maybe Zero is the Michael Corleone, but we've got Sonny the fucking Bull, and we've got Fredo the Fool, but we don't have the guy that actually would, you know, Loy. I think Loy is the Michael Corleone in this show, and I just don't. I'm having a hard time at the halfway point of the season taking the other side seriously, especially now that they don't have the law in their pocket, it doesn't seem like. How are they, what's going to happen? And I'm trying to think of, like, how Rabbi Milligan going rogue, that is going to, the Italians are going to know something's up. The Fadas are going to know that something happened. Rabbi Milligan went missing, never even checked in with the consigliere, and Antoon never came back, and there's no body. The cannons are going to think that they shot a son.
Yes. So, which is what Josto wanted anyway, right? He just wanted to blame it on Calamita.
Yeah, but I don't think they're ready for this jelly that's going to be coming.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, they need the guys from New York to come in, and they haven't met their conditions yet.
Neither of them.
No.
The consigliere, the only guy in his fucking series on that side that seems smart.
Yeah.
Look at him. He's flopping like a landed fish in this episode. He's scared to death. Because he's like, none of this, like, okay, we have to sue for peace. We don't have the strength for war. And we're not going to get the strength unless New York backs us. So we have to. And when you look at his face when Josto says, oh, we're just going to give up, we're just going to give in, he's just like, oh, God, I can't, you know. He's the old man that's going to have to clean up these little boys' messes, and he's not going to be able to do it.
Yeah, I'll say in Schwartzman's defense, I'm not sure he's perfectly cast in this, but honestly, I don't know who you cast in this, because Fargo was trying to do a very, very specific and difficult thing with his character, mm-hmm. which is to make a believably threatening gangster also look like a bit of a bumbling idiot. It's not even that he's a fuck up necessarily. It's that he's not taking himself seriously enough. It's, mm-mm. And that's a really damn hard thing to nail. And I don't know if you write, if you cast Schwartzman and then you write around him and say, okay, this is what Schwartzman can do, so let's lean into it. If that's how they got to that character, or if this is a case of like, let's write a gangster in Fargo, which they've done many times over and it has worked. Right. And then let's cast Schwartzman as that guy, and it's not quite working. But yeah, it's a very specific and difficult thing to do, so I don't want to take too much away from him. I just think, I don't know who you cast in this that can pull that off, but Schwartzman isn't a bad guess.
And I'm also going to throw out that I'm not even sure that this show is not getting exactly what it wants out of Schwartzman. Like, we might be, all of our analysis, like, of the Fadas might be just dead on. They're just bad. They're just bad at crime. And this is, like, the story of capitalism. Like, a superior product is on the scene in the form of the Cannon Gang, and it's just going to take over. Mm-hmm. I think, but my question is why is that an interesting story? Like, if that's the story they're telling, like, how are they going to make it interesting? And there's got to be complications. Like, I think it's so let me pull it back from the brink and think about things, brainstorm some things that can make this thing interesting. Josto is on the cusp of forging a political alliance to wed the Fadas even more into the official state apparatus of the city. So is he going to, once like the crooked WEF gets put, is he going to be able to, essentially get the whole police department? Because if the cannons fuck up and, like, let's say WEF dies and they're pinned on it, they're going to be, like fucking state, city, local, and marshals are going to come after them for killing a cop, right?
They just haven't advanced that ball much, right?
And the other thing I think is really key is what Loy says about fighting a mindset that, like, even if the cannons win, what does that look like? What does that look like in Kansas City? What does that look like? And they're pushing into the banks. What is that like? You can win the war, but you're going to have to fight against that mindset. Like, is that the true enemy? And do you have a half season to, like, make that interesting? I think that would be a cool thing to try. And the other thing is the supernatural, like this ghost thing is just kind of chilling out there. What's the deal? And the other thing that's interesting is, of course, I think Rabbi, the Rabbi and Satchel show is inherently interesting.
Yeah.
Mayflower too. So it's not like that, but it does feel weird that the A plot, that they hook you into is not the main story of the season.
Yeah, I don't know, because everybody's seeing it that way. Everybody's seeing it as, like, the thing they're most interested in, and it's working the best is this gang war. And I agree, but we haven't seen how everything is going to connect yet. So,
and it's also weird because, like, so who do you think is the mainest protagonist in this season?
It feels like Loy is, honestly. Because Ethel Reed has been almost absent for most of it.
I felt like the framing with her being the narration and all this stuff was very much going to be her, but she has really felt like a side character these last few episodes.
Because she's on a side quest with Orietta, right? Like, we don't know where Mayflower connects to the story at large, and so she can't seem like she's on the main quest because we don't spend enough time with her, and she's on a side quest, so.
Yeah, Mayflower's loosely coupled to the Fada business, or Ethel Rita's loosely coupled to the Cannon business. Neither of them knows the other, that other part of it. That's the case for, like, the rest of the season, how it's going to maybe play out.
They got five episodes to bring it around, right?
Yeah, and you're saying bring it around like, oh my god, it's on the hinge of, like, falling into some abyss.
When I say bring it around, I mean, like, connect all the dots, show us why these stories matter to each other.
Yeah. And the other thing is, like, it's entirely possible that this little 42-minute episode, which is like 2/3 of a real Fargo episode, quote unquote, it's entirely possible this is just going to be a rough episode and everything else is going to be pretty gold and legit. Like, you know, and there's been lots of great shows. Like, I know there's times in Breaking Bad, there's even times in The Wire where it's like, I got an episode, it's like, wow, that was driving down 10 miles of bad gravel road, but you know, you had to take that to get back on the turnpike. And
sure.
So it's entirely possible that this is kind of like where the threads of the season kind of started to show and everything is going to be fine moving forward. In fact, that's what I expect with this pedigree and the talent and experience that Holly's got. So that will bring our podcast to a close here on Fargo, the podcast. If you have some additional feedback that you'd like us to consider, questions about our takes of your own, send that into fargo@baldmove.com, or once again, forums.baldmove.com is where you can discuss Fargo with us and your fellow fans. That will do it. We will see you here next week for episode 7. And until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.